It's Danny from Wolves and Sports Medicine Team. We're doing another fundraiser this year, 12 days of Christmas, which will include raffles and auctions for memorabilia, which quite unique, really. We're 5 days in at the moment, and we're doing the 12 days of Christmas. So the first five have been great, and we've got raised quite a bit of money with unique items like the manager's signed cap. Today it's Pedro Neto and Pedenzi's boots that are worn and signed. So after last night, it'd be brilliant. I was hoping to raise as much money as possible for Cure Leukemia. We did a similar running challenge last year to raise money, but this year we thought we won't run, and the players have donated lots of really good items, which we hope to raise as much money as possible for Cure Leukemia. If anyone's interested in being involved or finding out what the prizes are for the day, donating, joining the raffle, go to our Twitter page, which is at Wolves Sport Med, and all the information's on there. Thanks for your help, and hope to speak to you soon on one of your podcasts. Perfect. Thank you, bye.
Shoot the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to a very special edition of Shoot the Defense. I'm your host, Owen, and joining me as well, a gentleman who has been there, done it, worn the t-shirt when it comes to coaching. It's Lee Johnson. Welcome to the show, mate. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure, mate. And I can tell by your background, you're in sunny London.
yes. It's nice. Need Start a bit of better weather, don't we?
Yeah, stark contrast to where you've been before, you know, Africa and India.
Yes. I think when you go to like when I was out in Africa, you don't realise how hot it can be, especially in India as well. The temperature over there was just unbearable at times.
How much weight did you lose?
That was a plus side. I've gone over there, probably lost about a stone and a half in weight. And that was just all water. That weren't no fat or anything. That just water. In general, working in those conditions is quite tiring.
Yeah, it's unimaginable if you haven't been there. You know, if you've been there and seen it, then you know exactly what you're talking about. But people such as myself who haven't been to Africa, I haven't been to India, I've heard the stories. But boy, it's rough, but not in a bad way. But you've got to be streetwise, so to speak. No.
Yeah, I think when I went out to Africa, I'd never been on the African continent before, and I didn't really know what to expect. And I remember coming off the plane, and you feel that heat wave. You know, you get off onto the runway and it's like, wow, that's warm.
And that's not the engine or the planes, is it?
That's the heat from the tarmac and the sun bearing down you. And it did take a bit of time to get used to initially. And you have to adapt quite quickly of how you work. And in particular, in India, we had to start training at seven in the morning because you leave it any later. It's just unbearable. It's not fair on the players and then on also all the staff. So you have to take everyone's, you know, health into consideration and how that impacts training. So we would start quite early and do an early session and then do like an evening session as well when it's a bit cooler. Mm. So yeah, you have to learn how to adapt. And also as well, like, you don't realize the importance of drinking water when you're in these countries as well. Like, I think we take that for granted here, where the climate's a bit more seasonal, let's say. When you're out in those extreme conditions, you're going through gallons of water a day and it becomes habit. And if you don't, you'll end up having, you know, heat stroke, sunstroke, and making yourself, you know, quite unwell, as I experienced the first 2 days in India when I started coaching. So
Yeah. We could talk about that one. We could talk about that one. Yeah. All right, I'll tell you what, let's start from the beginning. You were at Millwall.
Yes.
Schoolboy, I believe.
Yeah.
Right. You were there from the age of 10 to 16.
Yeah.
And you know, people look at Millwall now and they're, you know, a championship side that aren't doing too well. But back then, they had the likes of Teddy Sheringham, Mick McCarthy, Kenny Cunningham, Casey Keller at some point. But you were in the youth team, so you saw these players, I guess, from afar. But in terms of your development, what did playing for Millwall mean for you? Because I believe they won the FA Youth Cup in 91, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think like just because of the catchment area where Millwall is located, you're going to have players that, you know, are coming from that street football type, you know, environment. And they're very raw and very robust type players. And, you know, the players that I you know was training with back then were mainly all from like around the local area. Like I was traveling in from Kent. The academies back then weren't the same as what they are today. So we would still be training and playing with our Sunday teams. And it wasn't until you was 14 that you would sign a schoolboys form for 2 years and then you know get offered an apprenticeship, you know, if you was lucky enough. So it was a mixed bag of players, but I think from my background where I grew up, it was quite a rural kind of, you know, environment. It was quite safe and secure in that sense. And when you're stepping into like a completely new environment where, you know, the children and the players are not what you're used to, you know, you have to learn to adapt quite quickly, unconsciously. You don't really think about it initially, but you almost having to adapt like through, you know, through the way you train and the way you play. But, you know, I really enjoyed my time there. You know, I had some really good coaches that you know, helped me develop as a young player. But the training weren't like it is today, you know, that it was very old school. Very much, you know, this is what I say and this is what you do sort of thing. Whereas now it's slightly different. But I wouldn't necessarily change it because that's how coaches coach back then, and that's how they taught their players. So it was a good time for me. I had a good experience. It's a shame, really, that the academy system that's in place now wasn't in place, you know, like back then, because I think you would have had a completely different generation of players, you know, who were in similar age to myself that would have played the game, and I think would have really, really moved football forward in this country a lot sooner than it already has.
Mm. Which of your teammates actually went on to be first teamers at Millwall, if you remember?
Stephen Reid actually was the main standout player. And that's the only real player that really like, progressed. And he's had a wonderful career now. And he's now assistant manager of Scotland. And
you know, is he at Forest as well, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Assistant manager at Forest. And so he's done excellent. And so like back then you'd have like, they'd almost call them like satellite centres. So we'd have a centre in Southwark, which I trained at. Then there was one in the north of London and a couple that were situated in other areas. And then during the half terms, that's when you'd all come together because you couldn't really bring everyone together like you can now. And that's kind of how it was set up then. And also Millwall didn't have the finances, you know, available to kind of run an academy, maybe like they would have wanted to. You know, that was mainly focused purely on the first team's progress rather than the actual structure in an academy like we know it today.
Okay, brilliant. So as far as I'm aware, you went to Ebbsfleet, you played for Gravesend, Dartford as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But I heard somewhere that you didn't actually, by the age of 16, you decided you didn't actually want to be a footballer. You wanted to be a coach. Now, based on what you said about the coaching methods at Millwall, was that something that you saw and you thought, I can do things different? I want to do things different.
I felt, you know, like every kid, I had aspirations to be a professional. And I had a really bad injury when I was 15. I had tore my Achilles and it was during the stage where I was growing through my growth spurts and stuff like that. And it took such a long time to heal. And during that time that I was out, I just started to fall out of love with the game because every time I kept coming back, I'd break down. The medical support maybe wasn't in place like it is today. So I started to not really want to play football anymore, and not to maybe the level that I wanted to play at. And so with that in mind, it was something like, well, what do I do next? And maybe how could I carve a career out in the game still? And I remember playing for a team, and the coach at the time was just asking, like, what are we going to be doing? What do you want to do when you're older? And I said, like, I'd like to coach football. And I remember him saying, you know, it's difficult. It's not easy to get into. And I didn't really think much about that. It was just more about, like, that's what I want to do. And that's the route that I really decided to go in. So, you know, when I was at school, I did some part-time work, you know, some voluntary work just to gain kind of, you know, some experience. And it wasn't until I was playing for Grays and Northleach youth team that the academy manager at the time ran their footballing the community program and also had his own coaching business. He just said, look, do you want to help out during the half terms, get some experience? So that's what I did, really. And I really enjoyed it. And it was the first time I got any real money for coaching. And I then decided to do my badges. And that's kind of where it started, my coaching journey.
So if I'm not mistaken, you were in that, as you said, you're in the community program, but I take it there was a lot of involvement with parents, with, I don't know, guardians or little businesses, local community businesses that helped the football club in some capacity. I guess this was a massive learning curve because so many people involved in a football team where effectively there's only 11 players kicking the ball around on the pitch. But at the same time, you know, there's so many factors influencing how a club is run.
Yeah, I think like Grays and Northleach is like a local non-league team, and had quite good support. So they had a youth section as well. So we'd get a lot of the players that would come from the youth section, and we'd get kids that were coming from the local area. I think one of the biggest things that when you're a young coach is learning how to deal with people and deal with parents and guardians in particular. And I think even though I didn't have loads of contact with them at the time, but just the general kind of conversations you would have around like how a child has done that day, and maybe it may be like what they've done, in terms of like their football, how they behaved, if there's any things that have happened to them in particular that parents need to be aware of. Trying to have those conversations with an adult, and when you're a young lad at 16, 17, it really helps you like to develop, as a person, and develops your communication skills. And I think that's something that I developed quite quickly early on, unconsciously. It wasn't something kind of set out to necessarily like focus on. It was just you're in those environments and in those situations, you talk to people. And that's kind of how I trying to really approach it. And it wasn't until then I took the under eights of Grays and Northleach, and I think I was 18 or 19. So that was my first ever team that I'd coached. And you had a squad of like 12 players and 12 sets of parents, every parent wanting their son to play and do particularly well. And they see me as a little baby in a sense, I was young and quite naive, but I felt that I had to really stamp my authority early, not in a kind of strict way, but like, I'm doing this out of the kindness of my heart. I'm doing this, voluntary to help your son, play football basically. And I actually think that the parents really respected me quite early on there. And I had a really good relationship with, I think, every parent, of that team. But those experiences, and that one in particular, for 2 years that I was working with them, really, really helped me, because you're having to have like quite difficult conversations at times, and some that you don't really want to be having, especially when you're a young lad. And, it can be quite nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I was about to ask if you were kind of what's the word? Felt a little bit not threatened per se, but you do have a few pushy parents. You got to pick my son, and we've seen it everywhere. I remember when I was at school, there's a few kids that were selected in the team because the parents were friendly with the teachers and that kind of stuff. So were you under some sort of pressure to select certain kids because of who their parents were, or
not necessarily? Because what we tried to do early on was give everyone equal playing time, so everyone had the opportunity to play at least two periods, because we played four periods back then. And that was the minimum that you was going to give a player. I think there was one situation though where there was a dad, he was a West Ham fan, all tattooed up, you know, a bit of a lad. And he was quite vocal on the sides. And I remember one game in particular, he just got a bit carried away and he ended up making his son cry, and it affected the players from our team and also the opposition. And I remember saying to like the assistant at the time, could you go and speak to him and, you know, ask him to come and see me at the end? And I'd like to have a conversation with him. And I was really nervous because I was like, how am I going to address it? How am I going to say something that's not going to come across in the wrong way? Because I don't want no backlash almost. So the game finished and I remember the dad coming over to me and he's gone, before you start, Lee, I know what you're going to say. I was like, what's that? He's gone, you're going to ask me to keep quiet because I was shouting on the sideline and it affects the players. And I was like, yeah. So basically he recognizes what his behavior was like and he knew it was wrong. And then from that moment, like, he was really, really good, like good as gold. And he was always good as gold with me, but some parents do get carried away and it's like, I don't know, sometimes I just think it's a bit unnecessary, you know, they're children at the end of the day. How would we respond as adults when someone keeps shouting at us? You're just going to retaliate or switch off. And that's the effect it can have on a young kid, you know. So that instance was, you know, quite a good learning curve for me, actually. It was a good experience to have so early on, really.
It kind of helps you learn how to diffuse situations as well, yeah. I guess.
Massively. And we had a really good relationship, you know, after that period. And his son was a good little player and full of energy. He kind of took after his dad in many, many, many aspects. But I just felt that needed to be nipped in the bud. And he almost did it for me because I didn't have to actually say anything. And, you know, he knew what, you know, he did wrong. And I think that came from me maybe putting some kind of guidelines out at the start of the season saying, well, this is what we expect from you as parents. And this is what, you know, I expect from myself as a coach. And I think that helped. Yeah, that helped that year.
Fantastic. Brilliant. So you did your coaching license 18. I believe you was a gentleman called Nicky Johns. Is that right? He was the guy that kind of gave you that push to go that next step.
Yeah. So Nicky Johns was the manager at Dartford at the time, and he was running Crystal Palace's Football in the Community scheme, as it was called back then. And he knew that I did my badges, and he just said, "Look, would you be interested in doing some holiday work during the Easter?" And then we'll just see what happens from there. So I did, and I loved it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was, you know, it was really, really good experience. You know, it was something that I really wanted to do. And off the back of that, a full-time position become available. And that July, and, you know, I was asked if I'd be interested in applying, and I ended up getting the job. And, you know, that was my first real job, you know, in football, especially at full-time in a full-time capacity. So it was, you know, it was a really good like experience for me, my time at Palace.
Well, this is something that I can't seem to put my finger on, and I've spoken to many people who have even played for Crystal Palace, like Simon Osborne, Sadio Burton, and I've always asked them, like, what is it about South London? What is it about that part of the world where they've unearthed so many gems? Now, I know Crystal Palace have got a little agreement with the Valenti, which is Bobby Barry's academy, and I'm sure they've got other agreements with other clubs at the moment, other academies, shall I say. But Crystal Palace seem to have this tradition of churning out so many quality players. And I believe you were there. Did you maybe coach Wayne Routledge? Again, I'm not sure if I'm wrong there, but you've seen it yourself. What is it about that area?
I don't know. It's just, I think it's because the communities are so diverse. You got people from all different backgrounds living in you know, in Beckenham and in Southeast London. And I just think that produces a certain type of player. You know, I think London kids are street kids. They're so streetwise. They have to grow up quite quickly. And that was the difference between my childhood and, you know, the kids that I either played with or, you know, coached, you know, throughout my career, that they're just so streetwise at such an early age, and they're forced to have to, you know, do things a lot sooner than maybe they would if they was living in different environment. And I just think that shapes them as a person. You know, you look at some children, they might not have that support network that's behind them, and they see football as a survival and as a way out of where they've come from, and that's maybe one of the reasons. But because I think mentality has a massive part to play in a player's development, and I think you learn how to develop that at a young age. And I think in particular if you're coming from an environment which is very diverse and very multicultural, and you have to kind of, you're forced to grow out quite quickly, those things really help these young players to, you know, to develop a lot sooner. But then adding to that, their technical ability is quite frightening. You know, like you'd be playing in cages, kids are playing in cages, and they're playing with players, you know, 3 or 4 years older than them. So they're going to get roughed up in, you know, in their parks, you know, in their own environments. And it's almost like a sink or swim like situation for them. And like when you're a young kid, and I've seen it when I've gone into those kind of areas, you get young kids of 8, 9, 10 playing against 12, 13, 14 year olds. And the older kids aren't going to, you know, have a softy kind of approach. They're just going to treat that kid as if they're the same age, and you know, have to get on with it. And again, I think that really helps the players that development as well. But yeah, some of the players that have come through have been really, really good players, really, really good quality as well.
That's right. Absolutely. And in terms of your time at Crystal Palace, now you moved to Chelsea afterwards, but we'll talk about Chelsea in just a moment. But Palace has always struck, to me, it's kind of like struck a chord in the sense that their resources aren't as, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for at the moment? Their resources aren't like the level like Manchester United or Liverpool or Manchester City. So you're having to work with what you've got, right? So based on your previous experience at Gravesend and working in the community, I take it that experience helped you move into this role and use the resources that you have. And I guess that you had more resources at Crystal Palace than you did the other club.
Yeah. So initially my first job at Palace was I was a football development officer. So I'd be working in schools, delivering curriculum, like coaching sessions and after school clubs, holiday courses, etc. And so you were right out in the community, and the program was funded by the National Lottery and various other, you know, like funding partners. And that's what helped you to run and provide, you know, opportunities for kids to play football in the local area. But you're right. I think when I was at Palace at the time, the kids that were coming through Crystal Palace Academy were of a good level, but the budget in which the academy was being operated in was a lot less than, you know, its rivals. But it's just the catchment area. If you're in a good catchment area, you're always going to find players. It's just like when I was at Barnet, and I know I'm fast forwarding on, we would not struggle to find a player from, you know, coming into Barnet. We didn't have to recruit anyone because of where we're located, and it's easy access for people to get to. And I think that's part of one of the reasons. But I think, yeah, you do have to learn to work with the resources that you have available and make the most of what you've got. And I think one of the biggest things I tell coaches and people that I've worked with in the past, you have to be adaptable to any environment that you're working in. It's a part of being a coach and a part of being a professional. You know, nothing's going to be perfect. You're not going to have everything at your disposal all the time. So how do you operate when you don't have certain things?
Were you under any pressure at all to find a gem because of the resources, because of the club's hands being tied in terms of dipping into the transfer market and bringing in players? Did you feel that you had to find this player so that you can bring into the first team eventually and they can sell them on?
Not necessarily me, because, you know, when the role that I was doing, it was more if I see a player that was of a decent level that that was either, you know, in a school that I was working in or, you know, in another setting, then I would recommend them on. And that was my only real responsibility at the time. And I don't think academy coaches really feel a sense of pressure to necessarily find the next gem and develop the next gem. Players will develop when they're ready. You know, you're there to support a player and guide them. You're not there to really, you know, be put under pressure to find these little gems, you know, within the local areas. I think that's the job of a recruitment officer and scouts. I think they're the people that really have a part to play in unearthing, you know, hidden talent. I think it's up to coaches that when these players come in, is to nurture that talent and try to develop them in every aspect that you would want a football player to be developed, you know.
So would you say that's the same that applied for Chelsea? Because I know you joined them right about the time when Abramovich took over the club. Massive, massive transition there. Prior to him coming in, Chelsea were in millions of debt. Ken Bates, you know, with the way that he was running the club, don't get me wrong, he bailed them out the first time around, I think, in the 80s. So Abramovich comes along. I presume he pumped a lot of money into the club's infrastructure, the training ground. First of all, how did that move come about? And secondly, was the pressure intensified at Chelsea?
So the move came about because I left Crystal Palace and decided to set up my own coaching company that I ran in Kent and the southeast, you know, southeast of London. But I had a really good friend who's, you know, quite well known in the game now, and he's named Michael Beal, and he got a full time position within Chelsea at that particular time, and he said, look, would I be interested in you know, coming in and initially working in the development centres and then seeing what happened there. And it just fit around what I was doing with my business. So that was my kind of in. And then once I got my foot in the door, I ended up working with, you know, various age groups and a number of players that have like since like progressed and have done really well for themselves. So that was the initial like step into Chelsea. But when you go into that type of environment, I don't think anyone really can prepare you to understand what professional is until you're in it. Because even though, 2006 I was there, that's when I started, they was building their new like training ground. And at the time we was right at the far end of Chelsea training ground. It was a small kind of pavilion, but the pitches were immaculate, and that was where they was operating from. And the standard of players was really high then. And also the standard of people that were working in the academy was next level. And you learn quite quickly how to, you know, how to conduct yourself and how to work in that type of environment. And I think that really inspired me really to kind of go, right, this is what I want to do. And this is what I want to pursue in the future. I want to work at this level with these players and with these people. So yeah, it was a really good eye-opener for me.
Because I know you coached the under-8s and the under-10s.
Yeah, so I coached the under-8s, under-10s, and then you was able to go and work with different age groups as well. So, but primarily 8s and 10s were my main age groups. But then, you know, throughout the 6 years I was there, you know, I got the opportunity to work with other age groups as well. And I think that's good as well, because it gives the players an opportunity to be coached by someone different, a new voice, a different face, and it doesn't allow them to get too comfortable. But then also it gives a coach that may be working with an under-8 or an under-9 or a 10 an opportunity to go and work with an under-14. The coaching is different, the quality is different, you know, the expectation is different, and it's good for a coach to see that. So that provided me with a really good insight as to how the players would be progressed from like the foundation phase as it is now into the, you know, youth development phase. So, you know, that was good for me.
Did it frustrate you to see over the years a lot of Chelsea youngsters going out on loan and not really being given a chance at the first team, especially given how well they did in FA Youth Cups? Now, I know recently, over the past couple of seasons, Frank Lampard has been very happy to play your Mason Mounts, you know, Callum Hudson-Odoi, et cetera. I can't even say et cetera these days. But in terms of the players that you coached and you saw the way that they made that transition from you know, youngsters to first teamers, even elsewhere. Did it frustrate you to look at them and think, wow, you should have been in the first team at Chelsea, or at least pushing for first team place?
I think it frustrated a lot of people, you know, at the club, because there was so much good work that was done to get these players to a level. And then when they were knocking on the door of the first team and training with the first team squad, like throughout the week, and then not get an opportunity, you would think, why? But then Chelsea were fighting to be one of the best teams in Europe. They were competing for the Premier League, you know, and they were bringing in players from overseas. So to have an academy player, you know, reach the level of someone like Ballack, for example, at the time, Ballack's been there, seen it and done it. You know, an academy player coming through has got so much to do to get to his level. But it was frustrating, because as much as you would want to see these boys being, you know, being progressed, I almost felt that it was getting, you know, stopped in their development. But I think what Chelsea does in general, I think any player that would have played at the academy, is provided them with a fantastic education in football, so that if they didn't make it at Chelsea, they've got a really good opportunity to make it somewhere else in the football pyramid, whether that's in England or overseas, because of the experience that they get, the coaching that they get, the resources that they have to nurture their talent is, you know, it was world apart. And, you know, I know it's been caught up slightly with heavy investment from other clubs now, but I think Chelsea is still, you know, one step ahead of its rivals. And I suppose that's the positive thing. And I think they're trying to develop players for the wider game, as well as players for their club. And ultimately, there's only going to be 1-2% that are going to make it into the senior team. The rest will find a career somewhere, you know, hopefully in other divisions.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you a question, which I'm sure you've been asked on numerous occasions. When you see a 17 or 18 year old, let's say an 18 year old that signs a contract at Chelsea and they're on 30, 40 grand a week, do they lose a little bit of motivation to make it? Because effectively, when you're that age and you're on that amount of money, where's your motivation? How else can you better yourself, I guess?
That's a difficult question, because I think it's all down to the individual player and the support network they have. You know, I do think that players that get a lot of money early on, their heads can get turned. And, you know, when you're a young lad and you're a scholar and you're earning 150, £200 a week, and then all of a sudden you sign your first pro deal, and then your money then goes from a couple of hundred pound a week to like maybe £2,000 a week. For a kid of 6, 17 years of age, that's a lot of money, a hell of a lot of money. And in other, you know, instances, it might even be more than that. And I just think it's down to the club and down to like the support network around the player to make them understand that they haven't made it. This is a fortunate position that they're in. They've worked hard to get there, but to get to the next stage, they've got to work even harder, because as quickly as it comes, it can be taken away in a heartbeat. And I don't think enough really is done to support players in that way. And you know, you speak to people and it's always referred back to money. They should be doing this because they earn that much amount of money, or they shouldn't feel like that because they earn that much money. That's irrelevant to me. You know, we're all human and we've all got kind of feelings. At the end of the day, they're in that environment, they're in an industry that will pay that money because that's the market rate. If a player, you know, doesn't get maybe £2,000 or £3,000 a week from one club, he might get that from another club, and then that particular club loses out potentially. So it's very, very competitive. But I do think the clubs and the support network really need to make sure that they provide the right guidance for these young lads. And it's improved like massively over the years. But I think maybe back then when big money was being put into the academy, you know, setup. So I don't think that was in place like it is now. You know, a lot of the top clubs will have like player care departments, which would be responsible for looking after a player's welfare, looking after, you know, looking after them on the pitch and off the pitch, and helping them, you know, in making the right decisions. So I do think that's improved.
I guess there isn't a blueprint as to how players should really behave these days. Obviously, there's many things that they can't do, but in terms of their mentality, in terms of their behaviour on and off the pitch, I don't think there's, as I said, like a blueprint, because things that players used to do in the 80s and 90s are far different to what they're doing now. They can do things now that they couldn't get away with then, and vice versa. I guess that's just the way the game or the society has evolved.
Yeah, like, I think football is so much more professional than what it was. Like, you know, you may have even spoken to players that have recently retired, and, you know, that they probably could have done or may have done better if they had looked after their bodies, or, you know, better than what they did, you know, when they first started out. Because when, you know, in the early 20s or in the mid 90s, there was a big drinking culture in the game, and that's out there to see. People know about that. And I think that remained in place until, I don't know, maybe the mid 2000s. And I think when clubs started to realise that, you know, to gain certain margins, players needed to be looked after in a different way. So that's when, like, sports science come in, and nutritionists, and players were getting educated. And I think that education has moved on even more over the last, like, 10 years. And you see players today that really, really take care of themselves, take care of what they eat, you know, making sure that they've got the right sleeping habits. You don't really see many players going out nightclubbing and getting up to all sorts anymore. And I think maybe because of the fear of, like, camera phones and people being, you know, spotting them out. And there's players, maybe you couldn't do maybe what you was doing back then, like you could do today, because you wouldn't get away with it. So there's also that side of things. But I just think the game's moved on. It's got quicker. It's more physical. The demands are higher. Expectations are more. So I just think the game's just become more professionalized over the last, like, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Brilliant. Okay, right. You chose to go to Rwanda. Now, that's a very interesting career choice.
Yeah.
Huge country. Huge country. Interested to know your first impression of the place, because I know you were in charge of developing football at grassroots level, and we've seen many, many top footballers come out of Africa, but none from Rwanda.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's the case?
I think infrastructure. They don't have the infrastructure. And unfortunately, that's not just Rwanda. That's a lot of African countries. I think that because of lack of infrastructure and resources, players will, you know, slip through the net, and they won't get the opportunities that most kids will be getting in Europe or other parts of the world. So it's a shame. It's a shame. Like, I had an opportunity when I arrived in the first 2 weeks to tour the country and go to different parts and go to local communities, watch, like, local games that were being played on dirt pitches, etc. And it was a huge eye opener for me. And I just felt like, you know, these kids just needed the support, because there was so much talent. You know, I was just watching these kids playing with no boots on dirt pitches, and they were handling the ball just as well as a player in this country would, with everything, you know, with a good pitch, with, you know, the latest boots and, you know, playing in excellent conditions. Like, these kids in Africa, and they're exceptional. And it's, again, it's the environment that they're in. That, you know, they're playing on, they're playing on different types of pitches, all different terrains. They don't have the luxuries that we would have, and it's a survival for them to get out, because football, as we know, can provide so much for an individual and also for an individual's family. And that's why some of these kids, that's what, you know, that was where their focus was, to do well, to get found, to get out.
And did you find any similarities between your time in Rwanda to your original coaching role? Because as you mentioned, underprivileged kids and them not having the opportunities, I guess it works both ways.
Yeah, it's just a different. It's just a different environment. There's similarities there, but the environment's obviously very, very different. You're going to the extreme in some cases in Rwanda. But having said that, the country's like really started to develop. You go into Kigali, which is the capital, and you know they've got like a finance district now. They've got like a lot of infrastructure has been put into the country to help it grow. And
well, they're sponsoring Arsenal, aren't they?
Yeah, and the thing is that the Arsenal, you know, there's a huge fan base. You know, Arsenal fan base in Rwanda. And again, I don't think people realise how far the Premier League stretches until you go out and actually see it in another country. And I watched more football in Rwanda than I did living in England, because it was on all the time. Mm. Every other channel, there was a football channel and there was always games being played. So like the Premier League and even a championship we've watched worldwide in locations you wouldn't expect, you know, in places you wouldn't expect a TV to be had. You see the little TV, the box TVs with a big satellite and a congregation of people watching matches. So, and I think that's when the Premier League and big clubs have a responsibility to set examples and be role models for the wider audience, you know, across the world. And they have such a big part to play in shaping people. But going back to your initial point, I think players, like I said, in Rwanda, it is a survival for them to, and football, you know, is their way out. It's their main sport. So you see kids playing everywhere, just like we would have, you know, in England. You've always got kids playing football, especially, well, not as much now with the way society's yeah. been, but you know, there's more kids playing football, and you know, and it's nice to see. Right? You know, it was good to witness.
Absolutely. And what was it, Stephen Constantine that took you over there?
Yeah, so I met Steve earlier that year. We was both invited out to America to take part in the NSC AA Coaches Convention. And they've since changed their name now. But so it's the world's largest football convention. And
is that like SoccerX? Is that the one that...
No. Oh. So NSC AA, which is North America. I think it stands for the North American... North American Coaches Soccer Association.
Right.
I think something along those lines. But they've since changed their name. But they have these events all across the states once a year, and there's anything up to 25,000 to 30,000 people come through for the week. So that you know there's coaching sessions put on by guest coaches, presentations, and then there's an exhibition, a business exhibition, all related to football. So I was invited to go over there and present and do a session, and I'd never met Steve before, and Steve was over there, and we had a mutual friend, and through that mutual friend, basically, we ended up kind of getting connected, and Steve was in the same hotel as us, me at the time, and I just see him there, introduce myself, and that's really how like our kind of like relationship started in that sense. You know, we got to know each other during that period that we was in America, and then we just stayed in touch, and that really, I mean, that was really how it started. And he then got an opportunity to go to Rwanda and be their technical director, sorry, be their head coach. And he then phoned me and said, look, the technical director is leaving. Would I be interested in applying for the role? I think it would be something that'd be good for you and a good opportunity. So at first I thought he was joking, because I don't think people realize how big these types of roles are. And I surely didn't. And I ended up, you know, going through the process and going out there, and you don't realize how much football plays a part in people's lives in some countries, and especially in Rwanda. And straight away I'm in the papers, I'm on TV, I'm doing press conferences. Never done any of this before in my life, and it was a completely new experience for me. And it was like, and no one taught me how to do it. You get thrust into these environments, and yep. You're like, go on then, answer that question, sort of thing. And you're having to think on your feet quite quickly. I remember my first press conference, there was like 200 journalists and a number of different news cameras, you know, all honing in on me with a big spotlights,
flashing lights
up over there anyway. And I'm in a suit, and you got these big white, big lights like beaming down you, and I'm feeling the sweat coming on my face. And I was like, it's difficult, like, you know, thing to go through. But I suppose that comes part and parcel of being in that type of job, but it wasn't something that I was expecting to happen. I was probably a bit naive to think that I'd be taking a job and no attention would be coming my way. And obviously it was very different to that. But yeah, that's kind of how we met.
Is there one experience that stands out when you were in Rwanda?
I think, so when I was out there, I was coaching the under 17 national team and we played Uganda in the African Cup of Nations. And that was my first time coaching an international team and coaching a particular age group. So the level of attention that went into that under 17s team during the time that I was coaching during the 2 weeks was incredible. I remember the national stadium is in Kigali and then there's like a training pitch, a 3G training pitch next door. And that's where we started the camp. So I remember, seeing all the players, we got on the pitch and was getting ready to start training. And then you see all these like a herd of people like start to come around the side of the pitch. And they're all like journalists, TV crew coming around and watching training. And I'm thinking this is an under 17s like team. You wouldn't get this level of attention in England, necessarily. And I remember the first session that we had, I had to then do like an interview after training and they was asking me how the boys were, what's my experience like and all these things. And it was like, that was quite a surreal moment. And then that night I was eating dinner in the hotel restaurant and the bartender, I was like, our coach, he call you coach over there. He's like, coach. And he's pointed up to the TV and it was me being interviewed on TV. And it was the first time I'd seen myself on TV, on the news. And it was a bit of a pinch yourself kind of moment. But then that whole kind of 2 weeks that I spent with those boys and everything that came with that in terms of the training and the attention, the press conferences that we had to do was like a magical, magical moment. And I think, I'm not afraid to say this, but like when the national anthem was played, it actually brought a tear to my eye when all the players were singing their national anthem, how proud they were to be out there representing their country. And there was probably about 5,500 people in the stadium and people were trying to get in, climbing on the trees and on the roof. Yeah, it was mad. It was just a mad experience. So yeah, it was probably, that was one of my, I suppose, best experiences in football that I've had, I think, out of all of them, because it was completely new to me and something I'd never experienced before. And
kind of overwhelming, yeah?
Yeah, it was overwhelming. It was really overwhelming. And the boy, since then, actually, since my time in Rwanda, I still keep in contact with 3 or 4 of that actual age group. They were under 17s back then. So then now they've progressed through and they're senior team players and, they're making their way in the Rwandan league and some of them have actually progressed on to other countries to play, which is a nice to see.
I mean, wow. So, all of that in a year, right?
It was a crazy year, actually. We actually done a lot in that year. Like the national team went from being 134th to 64th in the world in that season. And that was huge for football in Rwanda, but also the country's morale as well, because like I say, the games followed and they're so passionate over there. And so how we progressed the team forward, and obviously Steve done the body of the work because of he was like leading the team, but it was we tried to professionalize the setup as best, best we could with the resources that we had available. And I actually think that really helped the players like perform when they were asked to.
Was it similar in India then? Because I know you're the assistant national team coach. You also coach the under 19s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So
23s as well.
And 23s, yeah. So yeah. In terms of the infrastructure, in terms of the resources, in terms of the player attitude, the heart, the desire, was it very similar to Rwanda?
In some aspects, but the finance and the infrastructure, was completely different.
Right.
India is a huge country. It's 1.3 billion people there. So Rwanda are 12 million people. That's not even half the population of Delhi. You know, so that goes to put it into perspective. Right? India is a huge, huge country. And they really, really wanted to move football forward. So they introduced the ISL, the Indian Super League, before the season before I arrived. And I think that actually really, you know, propelled the game.
Right.
You had a lot of like foreign stars come over, and
Forlan, Materazzi,
Zico came over and was coaching out there. And
My friend was out there with David Platt.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Lee Taylor, yeah, he was coaching with David Platt. He was the strength and conditioning coach, so he's got some stories. But
it was mad, and it's a shame the league was only like 3 months at a time. So they would train for a month and then they would play 3 months, and then the league's finished. So then the amount of football being played in India was a fraction of what it would be, you know, in England. So, for example, when I was coaching the under-19s were a full-time national academy. And so they had a national academy from under-15s up to under-19s. They had secured the hosting rights for the FIFA under-17s World Cup. So there was a lot of emphasis on seeing that under-17s team, you know, get the right preparation it was needed to compete at that level. And then, so we had the boys in full time. They was educated, fed, and, you know, accommodated, and then they would train every day. And I remember saying to the lads, like, you know, how many games do you reckon you've played since you was 10 to now? And one of them said probably about 50, 60 games. And I was like shocked, because you would see kids in this country, you know, doing that a season.
Yeah.
You know, so in some cases, some players are probably getting 10 times more experience in England than some of the boys of a similar age in India. So you're having to fast track them quite quickly, but also be mindful that, you know, they can't all learn at the same time. Everyone's needs are different. But in order for them to get to that next level, you know, there's certain things that need to be required for them to do that. So we really kind of tried to professionalize the game from like the junior team right away up into the senior team. So there was just like a natural progression. So there was we had like strength conditioning, sports science, GPS, you know, all of those things put in place that weren't in place before, that have, you know, a massive benefit to developing a player, because it's not just about what they're doing on the pitch. It's about looking after the player and their loads and all of that stuff as well. And especially in those conditions, you know, we were coaching in 45, 50 degree temperatures, you know. And so then if you're wanting a player, let's say you do a typical transitional practice in England, and it's of a real high intensity, you wouldn't necessarily get that intensity in India simply because of the conditions. It's like walking into a sauna with, you know, with the sun beaming down on you, and it just saps your energy. So you have to be really, really mindful of, you know, what your outcomes are going to be, you know, in those kind of conditions. But yeah, I think in going back to your question, there was a lot more emphasis on the national team's development and really trying to get the country's football in a whole into a better place across Asia than what it was before.
Mm. There's one question I really want to ask you about India before we wrap it up, mate. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. It's been close to an hour. This is incredible. Thank you. Okay. When you see how passionate football fans are in India, because they're everywhere. Do you know what I mean? It's a massive, massive, massive nation, and you've got supporters of Man United, Liverpool, et cetera, et cetera. Why do you think the powers that be, whoever have got that money to distribute it into football, aren't actually doing it? Because the only explanation I can think of is maybe because cricket is the national sport out there. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, it is a national sport. You know, the emphasis on cricket and the popularity of the sport out there is huge. Yeah, I wouldn't say it's like that. But I would, yeah, it's obviously a lot more popular than football. But I think with the introduction of the ISL and then having the foreign influence that came in during the time that I was there and a couple of years after really, really helped grab people's awareness of the game and their attention. You know, the crowds were really impressive. I think they was averaging about 28,000 a game, which was the fourth highest league across the world in terms of average attendance. So at the time, that was really good. I think for me, the biggest thing that, you know, that India really needs to make sure it does is be able to sustain its growth. So, like, they had the World Cup and there was a lot of money being put into, like, developing the stadiums and the training facilities. Now, when I was traveling across the country to watch games and see players, you would see a facility just being left to rot, basically, and the lack of maintenance and, you know, behind looking after those facilities was a shame. You know, it's like fast money in, a big injection in, there's no sustainability after, or not as much as what there should be. And I think they have to get that right to build the infrastructure and, you know, for the long term, have to make sure that whatever infrastructure is laid, they lay down, they've got a plan for the future and it's able to sustain itself, because that would be the biggest shame, because there's such a lot of talent in India, such a big country. How can you not find some gems with one of a population of 1.3 billion, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And,
you know, I just think if players were able to play the level of football in terms of the quantity of football like they do across the world, then they're going to get more experience, they're going to get more exposure, they're going to become better, the standard would improve. But it's such a long way to go. It's just such a long way to go. But I actually felt that during the time that we was out there, we really helped move football in the right direction, both on and off the pitch. And that's something that, you know, I'm really pleased with. I think we went on a 13 or 14 unbeaten game, like winning streak, which was a real achievement and hadn't been done before. And there's lots of other things that I could talk about that which we played a part in, but it's nice to see the players that were new to the national team back then becoming, like, you know, regulars and senior players within the setup now. And that's really what we wanted to try to create, so that when we did leave, there was a core group of players that can, you know, were continuing, you know, the development of the country going forward. So that was pleasing.
Well, you've laid the foundation, so hopefully they can build on that, really.
Yeah, I hope so. Like they have national youth leagues. So I think it's under 13s, 15s, 17s, and under 19s. And they're doing regional. So, like, they'll have like a regional league in Goa, they'll have a regional league in Delhi somewhere, they'll have a regional league in Calcutta. And they play each other once or play each other twice, and then the winning teams from those regions will come to a grand kind of like playoff final somewhere. But because the country is so big, it's so hard to coordinate everything, maybe how we can coordinate things in England. You know, so many kids playing football in this country, and there's so much grassroots football in place and junior leagues. And then adding on top of that, academy football as well. There's so many opportunities.
Exactly.
That's the difference between the two countries in that aspect.
Absolutely. Well, Lee, thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate it. Before I let you go, what are your plans for moving forward?
Moving forward, so I'm currently doing a course with the Premier League. So it's called the EHOC course. So it stands for the Elite Head of Coaching Courses. So that runs alongside my previous role as a head of coaching. And it's a four-year postgraduate diploma. So I've been busy getting all my coursework in and completed for that. I've got another year left of that, and then spending time with my little boy and my family, which is you know, very important, especially now. And then we'll just see what happens for the new year. Hopefully an opportunity will come up, and I can then get back in the game and kickstart my career and move forward again. So I'm just using this time really to focus my energy on my family, and, you know, should an opportunity come up in the new year, then that'd be great.
Brilliant, mate. Well, again, congratulations on everything you've achieved, and I wish you all the best, and hopefully we could do this again sometime. I know a lot of football coaches who would like to talk to you, especially about
your time at Barnet, which we haven't stepped on, but you know, it's Tony Cleantis' club, so we'll worry about that another time. We'll worry about Tony another time. But yeah, anything you want to promote on social media, anything like that?
No, it's fine. If you want to follow me, you can follow me on Twitter. It's Lee Johnson 80 on Twitter. So yeah, but other than that, that's fine.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time, mate. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Right, that's it for another week, guys. We're on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. We'll be back with another episode very, very shortly. So until next time, take care.